All right. We are up to Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12, and this ends the discussion of the conquests and then moves into how the land is divided up, at which point it's all geography. But Perek Yud Bet brings with it a couple of interesting points, as we'll see. The first part of it is going to be a recap, actually, of the wars on the eastern side of the Yarden under Moshe. And I put that on your sheet. You see where I gave you outline of chapter 12, the first, Pasuk Aleph Tavav, sentences 1 to 6. And then after that, it moves into the conquests on the western side of the Yarden and what we think of as Israel proper. And the theme is conquest. That's really what this whole parak is about. As I said, when we started learning Yehoshua, you get to the middle of the book, and it's the part that people generally don't read, because either it's conquest or it's geography. So right now we're in conquest. Next is geography. But the opening psukim, actually, well, before we see the opening psukim, there's something we need to be aware of first. And for that, I have a map in mind, and I think the stone has something also. If you... 2046. Right, so you could try the Google Maps part, but what I want to show you is where Ammon and Moab lived. It doesn't actually need to. We can figure it out based on the identifiers that you will have on the map. But basically, if you locate the Yarden, right, running north south, so the eastern side of the Yarden should be marked in some way. The northern part of it as the Bashan, and then below that Gilad, and below that Mishor.
Oh, if you look at 2044, it says of Bashan.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the bottom is Ammon. Yeah.
So they actually tell you Ammon and Moab?
It says Moabites, and then it divides up even further. Here, I'll show you.
Yeah, I've got from TK. So 1 second. You're looking at
this one.
That one. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually a very good way to do this. This is very helpful. They don't tell you Ammon and Moab, though.
They didn't have to conquer those
before. Oh, there it is. Ammonites and Moabites. Okay, yes.
They didn't conquer those before they crossed the Jordan?
No, they did. This is a review of what happened before they crossed. Correct. Yeah. So the point that I wanted to show you is the areas of Ammon and Moab that are towards the south, first Ammon and then below them Moab, because those present a problem. So you can keep a bookmark of some kind on that map, because we're going to need that again. But if you take a look on your sheet, I showed you three psukim in source number one. And if you turn to those, you'll see why I'm making a big deal out of this. Devarim Perek Bet Pasuk Tet is the first one. Chapter 2, sentence 9. So there, the Jews are told, Al Tatsar es Moab, Al Tisgarbo Milchama, right? That's what should be there. Right? Do not lay siege to Moab, and do not goad them into war. Moab, remember, is related to us, right? Moab comes from Lot. So Ammon as well. So they are considered to be our cousins, and we're not supposed to go to war with them. Hashem says, I've given that to the descendants of Lot. That's one pasuk. The next one is just 10 psukim later, pasuk Yetet. And again, it says, V'karavta mul b'nei Ammon, you're going to draw near to the descendants of Ammon, and something like, Al titzurim v'al tisgarbam milchama, right? Don't lay siege to them, and don't goad them into a war. Same idea. You're not supposed to go to war with them. Well, the problem is that the Jews do end up conquering much of the land of Ammon and Moab. There's some debate as to whether they end up taking all of it or not taking all of it, but they do end up taking some of it. So what is it that happens to allow them to do this?
And they attack them.
Nope. If you take a look at Bamidbar, they don't help us, but they also don't attack us. But if you take a look at Bamidbar Chaf Aleph Chaf Vav, this is the last pasuk I'll refer you to now. Chapter 21, sentence 26, you get the answer.
Mm-hmm. 21.
That's the one. Ki cheshbon ir sichon melech ha'emori hi, v'hu nelcham b'melech Moab harishon, etc. By Rashi Sarto. The Cheshbon was the city of Sichon, king of the Emori. He had fought the king of Moab, and he had taken his land, and it continues from there. So what happened was, the Emori, who are really a Canaanite nation, they're from inside the land, had invaded Ammon and Moab and taken part of their land. So it was no longer land of Ammon and Moab. And therefore, the Jews go to war against the Amori, and they end up controlling land of Ammon and Moab. Whether it's all of the land of Ammon and Moab, or only part of the land of Ammon and Moab, again, is a separate point. But with that as our foundation, take a look at source number 2 on your sheets, please, the Gemara and Ahura.
Are there repercussions for them taking over that?
Well, the repercussions are it's no longer Ammon and Moab.
No. They don't get punished for doing
so. No. No. So if you take a look at source number 2... You see the Gemara. Ki cheshbon ir sichon melech ha'emori hi v'hu nelcham b'melech Moab harishon, etc. That's the third pasuk that we just looked at. The Gemara asks, "May nafkamina? What's the difference? Why is the Torah bothering to tell me about wars that took place between Emori and Ammon and Moab? They're of no interest to me." The Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, to which the answer is, no. Hashem told the Jews, Al Tatsar Es Moab, do not besiege Moab. So Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Leisei Sichon leipok mi Moab. Veleisei Yisrael velifko mi Sichon. Let Sichon come along and take it away from Moab. And that's what we know about explicitly. We don't know explicitly that Sichon also conquers Ammon, but the Gemara assumes it. Veleisei Yisrael velifko mi Sichon. Now the Jews then get it from Sichon. Behind the Amar of Papa, Ezra of Papa said, Ammonu Moab tiharu b'Sichon. Ammon and Moab become purified, meaning permitted to us, via Sichon, the king of the Amori. It has applications actually for Shemitah in terms of some of the issues that come up with what part is considered part of Israel or is not considered part of Israel, as far as the lands that we took coming out of Mitzrayim versus lands that we took coming out of Bavel and the areas on the eastern side of the Yarden. So that's where this becomes a question
so
with practical applications.
Everything east of the Yarden is permitted in Shemitah?
I did not say that. No, it's much more complicated than that, unfortunately.
Yeah, sure.
So, with that in mind, now that we know this, take a look at the beginning of Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12. And again, we will need to refer to the map, but not just yet. Ve'ele malchei ha'aretz asher hikku b'nei Yisrael. These are the kings of the land who the Jews struck, ve'yirushu es artzam, and they got their land, be'ever ha'yardein mizrachah shamesh, on the other side of the Yarden, east to the sun, minachal Arnon, ad har Hermon, v'chol ha'arava mizracha, from Nachal Arnon to har Hermon, and that's a south to north description. Nachal Arnon, based on my map, is by Yam HaMelach. It's protruding east from the Dead Sea. And the Hermon we're familiar with, right? That's where you go skiing. The Hermon is way up north towards Lebanon. So he says, from Arnon all the way north to Hermon, the Chal HaArava, and the entire Arava, a term we usually use for plains, the Chal HaArava Mizracha, to the east. Because the Arava actually extends into Israel as well. But he's saying the eastern part, that's all east of the Yarden. I thought about trying to scan and send the map also. I apologize that I didn't in the end, but there are enough maps distributed. I hope that everybody has something to draw on. Surely you have in yours. Okay. And none in that?
Sure.
Okay. But that's the general description of the land on the east of the Yarden. The Dat Mikra points out that it stresses here, Hiku b'nei Yisrael, the Jews as a whole, took that land on the eastern side of the Yarden, meaning the 2.5 tribes who actually end up settling there can't say we conquered this ourselves. All of the Jews were involved in that. Okay. Then in Psukim Bet and Gimel, chapters 2 and 3, we get the boundaries of Sichon. Sichon being one of the principal kings, the king of the Amori, who the Jews fought before entering Israel. The other one is Og, king of Bashan, who we'll get to. But in that map, you noticed that the Bashan is to the north on the eastern side of the Yarden. Below that is Sihon's land. So that's what we're going to be focusing on now. Okay? Alina, you said you like geography, so this is for you.
Is this actually modern-day Jordan, then? This is
Yep.
It doesn't go into, like, anywhere out, like, further east? Like, to, whatever.
Where the edge is? We're going to get the eastern boundary mentioned, but I don't know how it matches up with the political boundary that is Jordan. So we're told in Pasuk Bet, Sihon melech ha'emori ha'yoshev b'cheshbon. Sihon, the king of the Amori who sat in Cheshbon, that was the capital city we mentioned already from Sefer Bamidbar. Moshel, he reigned, me'aroer, asher asfas nachal Arnon. From Aroer, which is a city on the edge of Nachal Arnon, so that's your southern boundary. You have that? They actually show you where it is? Okay, great. V'toch ha'nachal, and within the Nachal, the area of Nachal Arnon, this flow of water. V'chatsi ha'gilad, and half of Gilad, v'ad yabok ha'nachal, up to Yabok ha'nachal, another way to say Nachal Yabok. If you remember when Yaakov comes back into Israel, right, Yabor is not as Mavar Yabok, he passes Mavar Yabok, that's this body of water we're talking about. Gevul b'nei Ammon, and that's the boundary of Ammon to the east. So that really what's being described in Pasuk Bet is the southern border is Nachal Arnon. The northern border is halfway up into Gilad. And then the eastern border, as that Mikra understands it, is an extension of the Yabok River that runs east of this. Even though Yabok in my picture, on my map, seems to run east-west, in his commentary, he seems to indicate that it also then streams north-south from there. And there's some outgrowth from it, and that's what he's referring to as the eastern edge. So we have everything but the western edge right now. Right? Southern edge is Arnon, northern edge is Yabok, and eastern edge is some outflow of water that's coming from Yabok.
But wouldn't it just be the Yarden? Or not just, we don't assume that.
Right, so take a look at source at Pasuk Gimel. And Pasuk Gimel says, the Ha'arava, which are these plains, Ad Yam Kinrot Mizracha, to the Kinneret, the eastern edge of the Kinneret. It can't mean Kinneret to the east, because the Kinneret isn't to the east. So it means to the eastern end of the Kinneret. Right. Ve'ad Yam Ha'arava, to the Yam Ha'arava, which is also known as Yam HaMelach, the Dead Sea, Mizracha. And again, it's the eastern edge of the Yam HaMelach. It's not the Yam HaMelach to the east, because Yam HaMelach is to the west. Derech Beit HaYishimot, towards the area called Beit HaYishimot, which actually was referred to in Chumash already. Umi Teiman, and to the south, Tachas Ashdoz HaPisgah. Ashdoz is an area where water flows down, like a waterfall. So, under the waterfalls from the heights. In other words, what we're really describing is essentially the path of the Yarden running south from the Kinneret down to Yam HaMelach. But they're giving you the northern border of it and the southern border of it. And they're saying it's the eastern end of the Kinneret flowing downward to the eastern end of Yam HaMelach.
This is the borders of who? Of the Amori or Ammon?
So this was Sihon of the Amori. Sihon is the Amori. Okay. We will not learn the Ammon, the borders of Ammon or Moab, because they've been subsumed under the Amori.
But it seems to be here that's part of, you know, Ammon, or I don't know, like the way the map is here.
Yeah.
It just shows Sihon the Amori in that little rectangle on the bottom.
Right. And I think what they're trying
to the Kinneret.
Right. What they're suggesting with this map is that indeed the Jews, and because of the Amori, did not take all of the land of Moab and Ammon. And what you're marked in the white space as Moab and Ammon is the area that Sihon didn't get. Which makes sense, because Ammon and Moab continue to exist. We're gonna see Ammon and Moab throughout Tanakh, right? In Sefer Rus, right, Elimelech runs away to Moab. Ammon is going to be a constant problem for the Jews. So yes, they're not gone. They're not entirely subsumed by the Amori. Some of them were. Some of them were not. And that would be the idea.
So some of the land that Bnei Israel took was from Ammon.
Correct. According to this,
not just from Sihon.
Right. According to the Gemara, Ammon is in there. Well, no. What they got from Sihon was land that originally belonged to Ammon.
Yeah, but this part, like, there's two maps here.
Yeah. Let me say it differently. the Amori are fundamentally a Canaanite nation, meaning that their roots are west of the Yarden. Anything that they had on the eastern side of the Yarden, they took from somebody else. So what you're seeing is land that was originally Ammon Moab land that the Amori conquered, that Sihon, king of the Amori, conquered from them.
Yeah, I'm talking about the part.
Which part? This part?
Yeah.
This part?
Yes, this part here that they took.
Let the record show this part. Yeah. No, it's taped on the recorder. You aren't going to work. It's not going to work. So your question is about this kind of L.
Yeah.
Right? What about it?
That they took this part.
Yeah.
This is a part of God, but it's not part of Sichon. Sichon only went until here.
This. Well, that's the thing. Because this terminates at Yabok. Oh, we were asking about the contrast in the maps. The question is, if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're bothered by the fact that on the one hand, in the map that's marked with the number 1 on it, right, the left-hand map, it looks like God is taking land, settling in land, which in the map that's right next to it, the Jews did not take. It wasn't
like
in Sichon.
Sichon didn't take.
That Sichon had not taken.
It's part of Ammon. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Right. So I think we need to look back at this map once we get to the part where they divide up the land and see what they describe as far as what God did. And see why they... Because I'm assuming that's not a mistake.
But also looks like Menashe took all of the top part, which
was the only half of it,
right?
Why were we not supposed to conquer?
Oh, was that land of Bashan?
We haven't gotten to that yet. That's where we're coming to that next.
Okay.
So what we have right now is what the Jews conquered in terms of the land of Sichon. And we have our southern border is Nahal Arnon. Our northern border is the midway point of the Gilad region, Ma'avar Yabok. The eastern border is an area that extends from the Yabok as well. And then the western stretch runs from the southeastern tip of the Kinneret to the eastern edge of Yam HaMelech. Clear? We then get Og, Psukim Dalet and Hay, sentences 4 and 5. Ugvul Og Melech HaBashan Miyeser HaRefaim, and the boundary of Og, king of Bashan, from the remainder of the Rephaim, and we talked about that already. The Rephaim being this nation from before the Mabul, and Og's survival of the Mabul. That was last week's 2 weeks ago's discussion. So his land Hayoshev BaAshtarot BeEdrei. They dwelt in the Ashtarot in Edrei. Ashtarot itself is known as a city.
Yes,
so you have it marked off on there. Okay. The Dat Mikra does not. It looks for you to do your own work. You have to.
Yeah.
But that's Og's capital, and he is the king of Bashan. And that's that whole northern region on the eastern side of the Yarden, going all the way up towards the Hermon. And what it tells you is, Umoshel Bahar Hermon, he controlled Mount Hermon, Ubis Salcha, as well as a city called Salcha, Ubechol HaBashan, all of the Bashan, Ad Givul HaGishuri VeHamaachasi, to the boundary of the people of Gishur and the people of Maacha, okay? VeHatzi HaGilad, Givul Sichon Melech Heshbon, and half of Gilad, meaning the northern half of Gilad, and up to the boundary of Sichon, king of Cheshbon. Notice the word Ma'acha, that should sound familiar. Where does Ma'acha come from in the Chumash?
But isn't it a name?
It is a name.
Achan?
Ma'acha. We lean it on Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, no.
In the part that nobody pays attention to.
That's why.
Well, clearly.
Does it say something to
second day of Rosh Hashanah.
Sarah? Was he one of
Akita
the
second day?
Second day? Okay.
Brothers?
First day Yitzchak is born, second day he's nearly killed. That's the way it works.
Is it the whole generations at the end of the Akita that we're not...
Was it one of like...
There you go.
So
the very last one mentioned.
It
mentions the kids born from Nahor, right?
Because
it mentions Rivka in the group. The very last one is Ma'acha. So what that means is that what we're talking about here are cousins of ours. When it says the people of Ma'acha. Yeah. That's what we're talking about is when we say the boundary of Geshur and the boundary of Ma'acha. Okay.
Is this area that we're talking about the Golan today? I always want to refer
yes.
to it today.
Yes.
Some of it.
Not all of it.
No, to the north.
Syria.
Yeah.
And
yes, Syria might have some claims in here. Yeah, not to mention the Jordanians.
And, Jordan.
And the Lebanese when we get that far.
It's Jordan, isn't it?
Amman?
Amman
and Amon are actually not
Amon
synonymous.
Yes, is basically Jordan, no? And it's nothing to do with Amman?
I don't know.
I always thought it was.
Yeah, no, you know, it's a good question. Maybe it is. I shouldn't write it off as a possibility. I don't know. There's a lot of discussion about the city of Petra and where Petra is.
Yeah.
It fits into these various locations because it is such an old city. You know, it would have been around,
yeah.
But that's his own question. Okay, so that's the eastern side of the Yarden, and then we're told in Pasuk Vav, Moshe Eved Hashem uBnei Yisrael Hikum, Moshe servant of God, and the Jews conquered them. Vayitna Moshe Eved Hashem Yerusha LaRuveni VeLaGadi VeLaChatzi Shevet HaManasseh. And Moshe, the servant of God, gave it to Reuven, God, and half of Manasseh. Parenthetically, not for right now to go into it in great depth, but of course, when they initially come to Moshe and say, we want the eastern side of the Yarden, it's just Reuven and God. There's no mention of anyone from Manasseh coming to them and saying, we want this land on the eastern side of the Yarden. That seems to be something that comes in later, and the Gemara reads it as Moshe's own decision.
And they get the most land, it looks like.
And
yes.
That's only half of them.
And it's only half of them.
Yeah, right. They get more on right. The other side.
The decision seems to be, as one view in the Gemara presents it, that he wants to make sure they're going to identify with the rest of the Jews. So the way he does it is he takes a tribe and splits mm-hmm. them up, because they will always remember that their cousins are on the other side. He'll keep a connection. That's going to matter a lot at the end of Yehoshua. We'll see that surface as a concern. But what's the major problem that jumps out at you when you see Pasuk Vav?
Well, the Eved Hashem thing
is for sure. Like, why are we stressing that now?
And twice.
Twice, correct. And?
Well, it's saying he gave it to Reuven, God, and Manasseh, but not before. It says it belongs to everybody else.
Well, it said that everybody else conquered it.
Oh, conquered it.
But there is something here in terms of a contrast with Pasuk Aleph. Yeah. In Pasuk Aleph, the Jews conquered it.
Now it's Moshe.
In Pasuk Vav, it's Moshe with the Jews. Which is it?
Well, it is to distinguish that it was Moshe, not Yehoshua, not under Yehoshua.
Well, they all know it wasn't Yehoshua. Why would they think otherwise?
Well, Moshe's part of Israel, so...
They singled them out once, not the other time.
And Moshe, that it was given to Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. That it was
Moshe's decision. Okay, so there's a possibility. Right? We're not really stressing Moshe's role in the conquest. We're stressing Moshe's role in the decision to give it to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Okay.
And then ultimately Hashem.
And the fact he says Eved Hashem, that God approved...
That God approved of the decision.
Yeah.
Could be.
Because of Israel, not Moshe. Like it was.
Right. So I'm going to add that to my list of answers.
But if you're not stressing the conquest, you just leave that whole first half of the sentence out.
Well, unless you're saying, because this is part of the... what this is really here for is to discuss the conquest. The division, the assignment to those shvatim is really a footnote. We're not going to discuss in this parak where what everybody else got, even though we're going to talk about the spaces. So that in and of itself does make sense. But I think the answer that Ruth is giving, that it's about the distribution to Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh, I think that makes a lot of sense. Abarbanel suggests that it's not really such great praise to Moshe to mention conquering only two kings when it's about to mention that Yehoshua conquers 31. So, like, let's not really, you know, single out Moshe here. Although Rabbi Nel then goes on to say that Sichon and Og are the equal of all the other kings on all the other sides because of their strength. That's one answer. If you take a look at your sheet, source 4, I brought you Ralbach. Oh, look at that. Source number 3, I forgot. I had written down the borders there. That would have made life a lot easier, huh? Oh, well. That's what happens if you make the sheet too early in the week. Source number 4, Ralbag. Ba'amar bazet chila asher iku b'nei Yisrael. It first said that this is what the Jews as a whole had taken. V'hine ra'ui sheyachez zeh l'moshe imahem. So really, it should have associated this with Moshe along with them. Ki'al yadona asah, it was done via Moshe. Uzeh zachar besov, ki Moshe eved Hashem u'b'nei Yisrael asuzeh. As in fact, they're going to say when they get to Pasuk Vav, that it's Moshe, servant of God, with the Jews. V'hine lo hizkir bazet chila shem Moshe. L'haroz ki Moshe av api shegadla ma'ala so me'od. The reason it doesn't mention Moshe at the beginning is to say it's not really Moshe's merit. The reason why they conquer those nations, Sichon and Og, is the merit of the Jews, which he sort of tempers by then saying, "Mitzad bris Hashem yisale." In terms of the covenant that Hashem had made, because of the covenant Hashem made with their ancestors. But it's not really about Moshe, as Ralbag reads it. He should be mentioned, since he's the leader, and so he makes it in Pasuk Vav. But in the beginning, we're going to say it's really the Jews. You follow? We good? That's an approach. So again, what we have here is Moshe's omission in Pasuk Aleph, introduction in Pasuk Vav. We have the answer Ruth gave. Pasuk Vav points out the distribution to Reuven and Gad, and half of Menashe. And it makes sense to mention Moshe, and to mention Moshe as the servant of Hashem. And I think that's one solid answer. Barbanel says, it's not really such great praise for Moshe, so therefore we don't put him in the beginning, we just mention him when we get to Pasuk Vav. Ralbag says that it's because the merit is really that of the nation. I had one other thought as a possibility, and that tied to Medrash Tanchuma in source number 5. Bo re'eh, ein ma'asim shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu k'ma'asei melech basar v'dam. See that Hashem's actions are not the same as the actions of a king of flesh and blood. Melech basar v'dam yotzei la'milchama, legiono sav yotim lafanav. A human king goes out to war, his soldiers go out in front of him, they actually do the fighting. Im notzchim heim, if they win, ba'im va'osim atara u'machalalin oso, then they come, they give him a crown, and they coronate him. God doesn't do that. Hashem is the one who wages the war, and then he gives the crown to the Jews. Shneamar, because we have the pasuk in Tehillim where we say, Hashem is the one who actually defeated them. But he gave the crown to the Jews. Shneamar, Moshe eved Hashem ubnei Yisrael, whom it acts as though we were the ones who won the war. Hashem likes to give us the credit. So maybe Moshe is excluded from Pasuk Aleph because it's his way is to sort of play down his role. Maybe. Don't know. I like the other answers. So in terms of why we stress, though, the Eved Hashem element, that Moshe is the servant of God, why are we underscoring that? So Ruth already pointed out that one reason would be to say that the decision to give the land to Reuven and Gad is really Hashem's decision, and Moshe didn't do this independently. And that's one answer. But Malbim offers us an additional answer, which... Oh, I see. Yeah, you need to see source number 6 first in order to follow what Malbim is doing. This is a medrash in the Sifri, so this is among the oldest of our midrashim. It's halachic medrash. There's a pasuk in Parshas Ekev in which Hashem says, "Kol ha'makom asher tidroch kaf rag lachem, ba'u lachem yehyeh." Wherever you walk, that land will be yours. Wherever you set your feet. So the Medrash asks, "Ma tamad lomar kol ha'makom asher tidroch?" What's the point of the pasuk when it says, "Everywhere you walk"? Amar lahem, "Kol makom shetich b'shu, chutz mimakmos ha'elu, harei yushalachem." What Hashem is saying is, right now you're on the eastern side of the Yarden. Whatever you conquer outside of this space, in other words, on the western side of the Yarden, is going to be yours. I might think that they would have permission then to conquer outside Israel before they conquer Israel, because it says, wherever you conquer is going to be yours. So wherever you walk is going to be yours. So therefore, maybe you should say that they have the right to conquer outside of Israel before they even take the land. No, because the preceding pasuk says that you're going to conquer nations that are greater and mightier than you, meaning the ones who are in Israel. And then it says, wherever you walk. You don't want to have a situation in which they leave Israel to go conquer elsewhere first. So there's all sorts of idolatry. Remember, the whole reason we're brought there is to get rid of this Canaanite society. You're going to leave the Canaanim thriving in Israel while you go off and conquer some other area in Uganda or something. He says it doesn't work. Ela mishatich b'shu eretz Yisrael tohu rasha'im l'chabesh chutz la'aretz. Once you've taken care of Israel, then you can go on your adventures elsewhere. And in fact, this medrash is brought to explain that David HaMelech at one point conquers an area called Syria, which is associated with Syria, up way up north. What happens is there's an attempt to send condolences to the king there when his father passes away, and then he comes back with an insult. He shaves half the beards of the emissaries who had come to him, and that leads to a war that David HaMelech fights with the people there. He accidentally ends up conquering the land of Aram in Syria. And that land is sort of quasi-Israel. The Gemara called it Kibush Yachid, private conquest. And the question is, why is that private conquest? Why isn't that part of Israel? And the answer is because it was done before Israel proper had been settled. And that's not, as the Sifri says, that's not the way it's supposed to be done. Which leads me to Malbim's point. Malbim says the reason why we need to stress that the conquest on the eastern side of the Yarden, and not just the conquest, but the division of the land, was by Moshe Eved Hashem, is to say he did it at Hashem's word, and it wasn't a violation of this mitzvah of taking the western side of the Yarden first. Clear? Good. Okay, so we've seen the eastern conquest. We understand where Sichon is in the south. We understand where Og is in the north. And that brings us to the western conquest. And that's going to take us the rest of the parak, and not very long, because as you'll see, it's a fairly straightforward read. As you'll see, Ve'ela Malchei Ha'aretz Asher Yikal Yehoshua Ubnei Yisrael Be'ever Hayordain Yama. These are, the kings of the land that Yehoshua conquered with the Jews on the other side of the Yarden west. Mibal Gad Bibikat Halavanon, from Baal Gad in the Lebanon Valley up north. All the way down to the smooth mountain that ascends to Seir. Seir, Edom, Esav, those are all in the south. So, all the way north to south. And Yehoshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as an inheritance according to the portion they're supposed to get. Bahar uba shefela, uba arava, uba ashedos, the mountain, the low-lying areas, the Ashedot, where the water comes pouring down, Uba Midbar, the wilderness, Uba Negev, the drier area in the south, Hachiti, Ha'emori, Vaknani, Haprizi, Hachivi, Vayevusi, right? Six out of the seven nations, as we've discussed at other points, the Girgashi, having fled. So you only have six tribes there. Okay. Then we get our list. Right? Pasuk test. This is the part you're supposed to do all in one breath. The Melech Yericho Echad, King of Yericho, is one. Melech Ha'ay, Asher Mitzad Beit El Echad, the King of Ai, who is next to Beit El, is one. And of course, this we remember from our initial conquest of the land. Melech Yerushalayim Echad, the King of Yerushalayim.
All killed? This is what we're listing?
Yes. Okay. All the kings who he killed. Melech Yerushalayim Echad, Melech Chevron Echad, the King of Chevron as well. These all are going to be from the wars of the south, the initial ones. Remember, they fought first the wars of the south and then the wars of the north. So, Melech Yarmus Echa, the king of Yarmut, Melech Lachish Echa. I don't think you really need me to translate. Right, so that's one thing that we have to come back to, is what in the world is this?
One is.
Right, so that's something we have to figure out, is what this is all about. So it's Melech Yarmut Echad, I'm going to stop translating. Melech Lachish Echad, Melech Eglon Echad, Melech Gezer Echad, Melech Devir Echad, Melech Geder Echad. Still within the southern kings at this point. Melech Charma Echad, even though Charma will only be conquered in Shoftim, Melech Arad Echad. And then it shifts to talk about the other parts of the country up to the north. Melech Livna Echad, Melech Adulam Echad, Melech Makeda Echad, Melech Beit El Echad, Melech Tapuach Echad, Melech Hefer Echad, Melech Afek Echad, Melech Lasharon Echad, the Melech Madon Echad, Melech Chatzor Echad, Melech Shimron Meron Echad, Melech Achshaf Echad, Melech Tanach Echad, Melech Megiddo Echad, Melech Kedesh Echad, Melech Yaknaam LaKarmel Echad. It's good, this section can use music. Melech Dor LeNafas Dor Echad. The Nafas Dor is assumed to be villages of Dor that are outside of Dor. Melech Goyim LeGilgal Echad, Melech Tirza Echad, and Kol Melachim Shloshim VeEchad. That's your 31. The one there, that's Melech Tirza, is suggested that it's associated with Tirza, the daughter of Tzlachad, right? One of the daughters, that this is the land that she got, and therefore it was called Tirza because in the end it was hers. So, with this list that we have here. Yes, well, these are all the kings from wars that were already fought.
So these had already been
fought. Yeah, well, not all of them have already been fought. Right, and if you take a look on the flip side of your sheet, at source number 11, I'll just mention it now because you ask. Malvim's view is, Bein ha-malachim shechashav po hayu rabim shelo kavash es artzam bechayav. Among the kings we mentioned here are some whose land is not conquered, actually, when Yoshua is still alive. Rag ha-malachim nehergu al yidei Yoshua b'milchama, but Yoshua killed their kings in war, some of the wars we mentioned. Vehem, and he lists, Melech Yerushalayim is one of those, Melech Gezer is another one of them. There are quite a few that are that way. But what I wanted to note are two things besides that point about the kings. Number one is this odd listing. Right, Melech. This one, Echad, 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 Echad. Like, what does that sound like to you when the text goes that way?
Wants to emphasize it.
Could be.
The thing at Yom Kippur.
No.
Achas, achas, v'achas, achas, v'shaim. Good. So, what is that for?
To make sure it's coming up. Counting. I don't know. To make sure
it's counting.
Not make counting.
Well, in the Beit Hamikdash it was, but why is it structured that way when we do our piyut?
So. Each one is important.
Each one is important? Could be. How is it written in your Navi? I don't know about the ones in those. Do they write it the way it appears in these?
Yeah.
Right. The way it's supposed to be written, yours not. Wow, that must be dull reading it as a paragraph. The way that it's supposed to be written is the way you see it in your Tanakh, right? Except yours, sorry.
You don't know about yours because you're.
But if you had a Yoshua cloth, right, if you had it on parchment, this is what it would look like. Running down the page with the Melech, 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 Echad, Echad, Echad. It reminds me of a kid. Which one of my kids was it? Hi, Amram, if I had to guess. Who was reading it to Piskam on the second day of Shavuos, right in the beginning of the Haftarah, right after your first Pasuk or after your Bracha, depending on your Minhag. So you have this poem of Yitziv Piskam. So if you remember the way it's written in your Siddur, it's line of Aramaic, and all lines of Aramaic end with Resh Yud Nun Rin. And it's meant to have the poetry of it that you have this whole thing on one line, then Rin at the end. So he read all the way down, and then Rin, 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 Rin. But in terms of the what
isn't
this
it like
is,
listen like bad guys.
Is it?
I don't know. Like Haman's sons are also listed like this too.
Right. That's the other one we list this way. Is Haman's sons? Tell me when you see in general in Chumash when you see something written in a style like this. What does it tell you?
They're really bad.
No, not because
they really killed them.
More poetic.
They're really bad.
Yeah. You know, also,
Ruth says it's poetic. Where else do we see it? Kilom Chasdo. Kilom Chasdo, good, which we call Halil HaGadol.
No, in Shachar.
Well, no, you're right.
In Shachar it's somewhere.
Az Yashir. Az Yashir is written this way.
Why is this poetic? This isn't poetic. It's just listen Cain's names.
So that's part of what we have to figure out here.
No, I mean, normally it's poetic.
Oh, normally it's poetic.
I don't know why.
This doesn't strike
you.
There's one other area that people might be familiar with in the Torah where it's written this way. Or not quite this way, but written actually as it appears in Az Yashir.
Isn't that like Shirat Devorah also like that?
Shirat Devorah is written like Az Yashir, yes.
What do you mean by Az Yashir? What's written?
Meaning in Parshas Peshalach, in the Chumash, it's written in this kind of an open style. Where you have I'm going to explain it in a second from the text, but basically, well, the way it's written in a Chumash, right?
Instead of like this and the columns.
Oh, there you go.
How about right, like Shirat Devorah, isn't it?
Like the part in
now I don't have to draw it.
When they can smile and love it. You know that
whole section of Kohelet? Ace in Kohelet, the ace poem. Yeah. Ace for this, ace for that, ace for that. Good, that's another example of it. So what emerges from the examples that we're giving is that these are all meant to be some form of poetry. As odd as it sounds to call a list of dead kings poetry, that's what it is. And there are two styles of poems. There is the one that we use in... Oh, no, we didn't get to the one, the other one that I wanted to mention. I don't think we mentioned. Ha'azinu. Ha'azinu is this way also. Right? So, the common denominator is these aren't written as prose. They're not written as paragraphs. They're written instead with white space. And there are nice divrei Torah about the white space versus the text. But there are two different styles. In one style, it is like a brick piled on a brick. You have one on here and one on there. And then the other one is more like a structure that will stand, right? The Yashir style, in which you have two bricks here and then a brick in the middle and the two bricks here. And it's much more of a supported structure. So
this one will fall down if you take one.
Well, just columns.
Yes, correct. So take a look now at source number 7, please.
Was it always written like that? I mean, the Torah.
That's the idea. This was always from the beginning. This is the way it was written.
It's not written like this. It's not kosher Torah.
Yeah. Take a look at number 7, please.
It's
the Gemara says.
Things weren't in chapters originally.
It doesn't say space. Actually, the opposite. Sorry.
Saying things space when it's not like this.
Right.
And I'm saying chapters, and it was all divided up later.
Right, chapter breaks, no, are not ours.
Or even the parshas were divided later, right?
Well, parshios by what we read on Shabbos.
Yeah, but, yeah,
that
it's, in the Torah, it's just continues.
Right, the original meaning of the word parsha was every time you see a break in the Chumash, or in Tanakh, where there's a paragraph break, that's a new parsha, the way it was originally used. And, yes, there was a lot more you had to remember in terms of where things broke up because you didn't have other ways to refer to things. The break of Prakim is a Christian innovation that we adopted out of necessity because of the debates that we were forced into where you had to actually know what they were quoting. And that's where it became, that's where that became useful. And Parshios changed a couple of times over time. But take a look at number 7. Kol hashirot kulan, all, and I'm going to translate shira as I wrote it here, poems. All of the poems, nichtavot ariach al gabei leveina, ulevena al gabei ariach. Leveina is a brick. Ariach is a term used in the Gemara in different places to refer to a half brick. It's a brick, but it's only half length. So, in general, where it appears in the Torah, where shirot appear in the Torah, they're written in that style of kind of staggering. Chutz Mishira Zu, except for this poem, and they're talking about the one of the sons of Haman in Megillas Esther, Umalche Canaan, and the one we see here, the list of the kings of Canaan, Sha'ariach al-Gabe Ariach, Ulevena al-Gabe Levena, where it is piled up, brick upon brick, half brick upon half brick, my time away, Shalote Tikuma Lemapalatan, so that they should not be able to rise from their downfall. The idea is it just topples and collapses, and there's no way for them to climb back up.
So this one and Haman are the only two.
So it's not really the only two. And the commentators on this, right, the commentators on this point out that there are, in fact, others. I'm not sure why the Kili Olam Chasda was like that. Maybe because so many of the things that are described in that poem are the kings Hashem defeated, even though not all of them are. Some of them are about kindness as he did for us, but a lot of it is about those who were defeated. So this is a victory structure over the wicked. In fact, even Parshas Ha'azinu, which is another one that has this structure like the kings of Canaan, is because Ha'azinu describes in large part the downfall of the enemies of God, whoever those are. Two different ways to read Parshas Ha'azinu. But the point for us is this is meant to be a song to God. Not in the sense that it's particularly, you know, euphonious, like Melech this echad is never going to make it to the top of the charts. Nonetheless, it's a song of praise to God of, look what you did, you defeated all of these kings for us.
You don't have to say it in one breath, do you?
No, you don't need to say it in one breath. Nor do we actually lay this for a haftarah.
Yeah.
But yeah, hypothetically.
Try it.
Yeah, you can try it. Yes. So that's what this is. This is meant to be that way, and that's what the Echad is doing as the refrain. The Echad is like the Kili Olam Chasdo refrain. Okay. That's in terms of the way it's written in a cloth. And then one last point, because we've discussed this off and on. The issue of the kings themselves and their identities, who these kings are. I said last time that we met that the kings are kings of cities, meaning that they're not really kings in the way that we think of a king. They're better than a mayor. I mean, they can knock people's heads off. Only Ralph Ford could do that.
They're like tribes, really, aren't they?
Yeah. They're tribes that are part of a greater clan. There's something greater beyond, or maybe clans as part of a greater tribe is a better way to say it. But the point is that they're local rulers. So I found Ramban supporting this in source number 8.
It never says their names, it just says...
We had a couple of them whose names were mentioned, and we actually noted at the time, I think it was the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, that sort of the more powerful ones got their names mentioned, and the other ones were just vassals of the other king. Right. So if you take a look at number 8, Ramban says, V'itachin, he's trying to explain why they're called kings if they reign over small areas. And his answer is, it could be that every ruler of a city was called Melech. Or it may have been for the honor of the land of Israel, like the Medrash says, and I'm going to explain what he means by that in a second. However you answer it, these were not kings of lands. They were kings of each city, of each individual city. That's what we're talking about. That's the view of Ramban. The Medrash he's talking about is what I brought you in source number 9. Medrash Tanchuma. Ksiv, Melech Yericho Echad, Melech Ha'ai Echad, and so on. Ve'ein bein Yericho La'ai Ela Gimel Milin. The distance between Yericho and Ai is all of 3 mil. And as I added in the English translation, it's about 3 kilometers. A mil is 2,000 amos. An ama is 6 tefach. A tefach is, according to Moshe Feinstein, 3.6 inches. So if you do the math, you end up saying that a mil is about 1 kilometer, and you're happy to leave it at that. So when you think about it, how can you have a king in Yericho and 3 kilometers away, the distance between the bowl of blueberries and whatever we had before, how can you be a king when you have that tiny a space? That's what's bothering the Medrash. And yet he's called the king of Yericho. The answer is, it's not the quantity, it's the quality. It's not about how much land you have, it's about where it is. Yeah. If it's outside of Israel, you're not a king. Lama? Shahayu mis'avim la'aretz Yisrael, because they longed for the land of Israel. That was what they really wanted. Everybody wanted. Right, it's not just that. It's not just us saying it, but that everybody is saying it.
So we should call our mayors kings, maybe, in Israel.
Some of them think so.
They think they are.
Yeah, there's an idea. But that's that's on the Melech point from the perspective of Ramban, supported by this Medrash. However, Radak disagrees. If you take a look at source number 10, he says, each of these kings was not only the king on one city, so there, but each city that's mentioned was the seat of his empire, right, like the capital. He also had other cities and he had villages. I'm not sure what Radak is basing this on. I think Ramban's point is well taken, especially because he has this medrash that says only 3 kilometers between Ai and Yericho. But the bottom line is that what's bothering Radak is you had only 31 kings in the entire land, and that's it. That's your conquest. So his answer is, there are more than 31 cities. Each of these kings controls a much larger space. I think that's what's driving Radak. What's driving Ramban is simply the proximity of each of these cities to each other and how it just doesn't work. So I think each of them is being driven by something else within this. So not to mention, we saw how quickly these wars went. And even with all the miracles and everything else, the nation is moving from point to point to point.
Having to get there.
Right. So, I'm going to leave it with this. That's the conquest of the eastern side of the Yardin, and then we get the western side of the Yardin, and then we start next time, God willing, with Perek Yud Gimel, chapter 13, and the division of the land. Thank you.